WFHR Wisconsin Rapids, 1320 AM, and W248DE broadcasting at 97.5 FM.
This is Matt LePay, and you're listening to your home for your Wisconsin Badgers on 97.5 FM and 1320 AM WFHR, locally grown radio.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Rocket Mortgage.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky stands in the U.S. Capitol saying thank you for the aid given to his country in its fight against Russia's invasion. He tells a joint meeting of Congress,
"Your money is not charity. It's an investment in the global security and democracy that we handle in the most responsible way."
CBS's Ed O'Keefe.
Zelensky there in front of the U.S. Congress in prime time across the United States called for regime change in Russia and for an expansion of this conflict to include Iran and the fact that it is now working with Russia to provide unmanned aerial drones to take out parts of Ukrainian infrastructure and Ukrainian civilian society. Those are statements that U.S. officials have not made before, at least not in this kind of a setting, and it's notable that he did it tonight.
A storm that can produce blizzard conditions is due to hit the central and eastern U.S., as CBS's Chris Van Cleve reports.
Chicago is in the bullseye. Kelsey Hicks is now leaving a conference there early, hoping the storm doesn't steal her Christmas back home in Arkansas.
I've waited a long time to get to come to this particular conference, and I'm going to be stubborn and wait it out as long as I can, and I hope that doesn't come back to bite me.
She's among nearly 113 million expected to travel for the holidays. Most will drive just as the storm reaches its peak.
Georgia Governor Brian Kemp has declared a state of emergency ahead of the dangerous wind and cold.
This will help us ensure that essential supplies, especially propane, can be delivered for both commercial and residential needs.
More asylum seekers are arriving in major cities from Denver to New York as the U.S. Supreme Court considers whether to lift Title 42. CBS's Bradley Blackburn.
A charter bus carrying dozens of asylum seekers arrived in New York City Wednesday, adding to the city's growing migrant crisis. Officials say they expect the end of Title 42 will lead to an even bigger influx.
¿Por qué viniste a los Estados Unidos?
Buscando un mejor empleo, una mejor oportunidad de trabajo.
Jose Rodrigo told us he arrived 3 days ago. He says he left Venezuela hoping to find work and better opportunities.
New York City has converted several hotels into humanitarian relief centers where new arrivals are offered food, shelter, and other services.
The World Health Organization is concerned about a spike in COVID-19 infections in China. WHO Emergencies Director Mike Ryan says they want to see more detailed information on China's vaccination program.
I think there have been a 600% increase or more in vaccination rates over the last week or 2 weeks. So I think what we're seeing is that China is recommitting itself to that strategy.
This is CBS News.
Presented by Rocket Mortgage. Whether you're looking to purchase a new home or refinance yours, Rocket Mortgage can help you get there. For home loan solutions that fit your life, Rocket can.
Eric was way behind on his taxes.
I owed a lot of money to the IRS, almost $15,000. I tried to make payments.
The IRS wasn't satisfied with Eric's efforts, so they came after him full force.
They're coming to put a lien and a hold on all my income, my home, my car. I was just overwhelmed at what to do.
Then Eric called Optima Tax Relief.
When Optima Tax got involved, the calls would stop, the threats would stop. It was easy, like, 1, 2, 3.
Optima Tax Relief is A-plus rated by the Better Business Bureau, and their team of expert tax professionals took care of Eric's problem.
I owe $15,000, and now my debt is clean. I don't owe anything.
Take Eric's advice.
If you have a tax problem, you need to call Optima Tax now.
Call Optima Tax Relief for a free consultation. Call 800-343-6460. 800-343-6460. 800-343-6460.
Optima Tax Relief.
Some restrictions apply. For complete details, please visit OptimaTaxRelief.com.
The Badgers.
Under pressure, down he goes.
The Cowboys.
Tightrope to sideline, to the 10, to the 5. Touchdown, Wisconsin.
Live from Chase Field in Phoenix, Arizona.
They win the game. They are bowl eligible, and they keep the Freedom Trophy.
It's the Guaranteed Rate Bowl. Join us Tuesday. Our coverage begins at 7 p.m. on your home for Wisconsin football.
Catch all the postseason action right here on WFHR, locally grown radio.
Childhood.
should be the happiest time of life. But for many children living in poverty with blindness, facial deformities, and other crippling conditions, it's riddled with pain, rejection, shame, and isolation. At Mercy Ships, we're answering the cries of some of the world's most forgotten children and adults through free, life-changing surgeries, surgeries that turn despair into hope. These once heartbroken boys and girls, and many men and women too, are now restored, accepted, and on their way to a life of opportunity and joy. No one can change the world on their own, but together we can transform it by restoring hope to one person, one child at a time. Volunteers from your community and around the globe are bringing life-changing healing and hope to the forgotten poor. To learn how you too can help change the world, one child at a time, go to mercyships.org today.
Here's your forecast from locally grown radio WFHR. A winter storm warning continues until 6 a.m. Saturday morning. Snow likely tonight, otherwise overcast. Lows dip down to about 3 above. East winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Cloudy tomorrow, snow likely 13 below tomorrow night, chance of snow. 5 to 10 inches of snow tonight through tomorrow. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki. Currently, it's 5 above.
Serving central Wisconsin since 1940.
WFHR, Wisconsin Rapids.
I think the one thing that the mastery of the Trump era was the refocus on manufacturing, the refocus on the golden age of the American working class, the prosperity of the working class era. And what I'm hoping to be able to do is pick up on that spotlight, but move it in a more positive direction. But I think it's important to go back and maybe look a bit how things used to be, what it took to build that prosperous working class of the past. I'm here to share some thoughts. I've asked my good friend Dean Showers to come talk with us. He's a former president of United Steelworkers Local 6996 there in Reading, Pennsylvania. Dean, thanks for taking time for us.
Sure.
You know, we often hear people talk about, especially, you know, 2015, 2016, a lot of people were talking about, you know, manufacturing, how things used to be, you know, the clinging to that pride of the past that, hey, we used to build stuff. And of course, with that prosperous working class, those good union jobs of the past. You know, tell me, you know, when you think back to that era, what comes into your mind?
Well, thanks for having me on, Rick. You know, I'm a born in Reading, lived there my entire life up until 2017, and I worked there since I was 18 years old. I was fortunate. I came out of high school, didn't really have a plan, went to college, but at the same time I was going to college, I was working the midnight shift, and I went into a job in the steel industry. I was still, I think it was 18 or 19, and I was fortunate. I stayed there until my entire working life, and I don't regret that. I've seen a lot of ups and downs. When I got out of high school, Reading and Berks County in general was a huge manufacturing base. You could have actually walked out of high school and you could apply it numerous employers, and no doubt you would get a call to come in for an interview. In my particular case, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to go to college, but I wasn't sure about that whole thing. So I figured, look, I'll go to college and I'll try to find a job working nights where I can go to college during the day. And I did that. And I applied at three pretty big employers in the area, and I got a call from all three to go in for interviews. And I took the one I remained at because they had a steady 11 to 7 shift, and I didn't want to swing shifts because I knew I did want to go to college during the day and see where that took me.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting you bring that up because, you know, I'm thinking back to, you know, a couple of years ago when former Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett slashed the higher education budget. And, you know, at one of the rallies, there was a kid who was there, you know, I spoke to as I was getting ready to speak. And he said, you know, kind of the same thing. You know, my grandparents and my parents' generation, you know, they wanted to go to college, but they really couldn't for one reason or another. And they were able to go to the mill and they were able to find factory jobs and their lives. They led great lives. But those factory jobs are gone. So the fact that you had that opportunity to choose between, hey, do I want to pursue a college education or do I want to get a good paying union job, a good paying job that I'm going to be able to support myself? That's where I'd like to see us get back to.
Sure. And one of the things, you know, when I made the choice to work and go to school, you know, I already committed that I wasn't going to ask my parents to fund my education because, number one, I didn't want to cheat them because I wasn't sure I was going to stick with it. And, you know, by being able to work in manufacturing and go to school during the day, you know, it provided a means for me to pay my way. And I'm happy with that decision. And, you know, so, you know, the robust manufacturing community, I mean, just about everybody I knew had somebody, a family member, a friend that was working in manufacturing, either for one of the big employers or one of the small employers. And as years went by, you know, there were some ups and downs, especially when NAFTA happened. There were big layoffs. Actually, layoffs became a thing at some point. I can't put a year on it, whether it was late 90s, early 2000s, but just about every manufacturing facility just became one of those things were great for a couple of years and then things were bad for a period of time till they picked up. Unfortunately, as time went on, those periods where things picked up became less and less because manufacturers had started to shutter their facilities or downsize their workforce. And probably by 2000, we seen a whole lot of that going on, and that lasted 2000 into the time I left in 2017. A good example of that is I don't remember what year I became local union president, but I do know in somewhere around 2000, and I wasn't the local union president in the year 2000, but we had about, I believe we had about 2,700 members in the local union in the county, and that spanned over probably 13 employers. When I left in 2017, we were down to about four employers, and we had about a membership of 600. And most of that was because employers closed down or relocated their facilities overseas. And we that was just the steelworker locals. Yeah. I mean, that wasn't something that we were just solely happening to us. That was happening across the board, whether you were a union worker or a non-union worker. And, you know, I blame that a lot on, you know, flawed trade laws. You know, I've spent the later half of my career in manufacturing. Not only did I work and try to administer over to local union and our contracts, I also advocated, I bought into the steelworker approach that we need to change laws. We need to make things where we don't struggle to compete. We can compete with anybody, but we have to have the level playing field to compete. And, you know, in order to do that, we had to come to grips with, we have to become political. We have to become political in a sense where we have to go to Harrisburg and every state capital and down to DC, and we have to argue for why they need to pass laws that make our employers able to compete with the influx of imports that are coming in, especially from China at that point. China, you know, I guess the best way to describe China's manufacturing policy is whatever it takes to corner the market.
Yeah, mercantilist policy, that whatever they can do to dominate and take over, whether it's exploit labor, whether it's exploit the environment, or, you know, steal, lie, cheat, and steal. It's what they've done. But again, we're in a moment, Dean, and this is where I think it's important to look at the policies that this administration right now is pursuing. Buy American seems to be front and center. Investment in manufacturing is happening. Investment in infrastructure is happening. And a conversation about strengthening workers' rights and organizing and joining and forming unions. So to me, that recipe, again, is there to move us back into a very positive direction, one that a lot of people, I would argue yourself, would see as something positive.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, it took us a short period of time to get in the hole we're in because of a lack of vision from the lawmakers in D.C. and in some cases in our state capitals. So it's going to take us a while to march out of that hole. But I see in the last few years, you know, Americans are starting to get it. And what I mean by starting to get it, they understand how we need to make things here in the U.S. for us to be competitive and be safe. And the pandemic, if it proved anything, it proved how vulnerable we are when we have a crisis. And even though that was a health crisis, it just shined a big spotlight on all the things we've done wrong over the last 20 or so years or more. And so people are getting it now, and politicians are starting to pay attention to that. And now we're getting stuff done. A lot of the programs and bills that have been passed in the last 2 years around manufacturing and Make It in America and Buy America, the infrastructure package. These are huge steps forward, where we can start righting all the wrongs of the last years. And Reading is a good example. Now, I've been out of Reading since 2017, but I still have roots there. I have family there. I can't talk about what Reading's doing to recover, but Reading has unique opportunities. They were the poorest city in the country probably 7, 8, 9 years ago. I don't remember what that year was, but they were designated the poorest city in the country of a population of their size. I believe Reading has a population somewhere of 85,000 or so. But Reading has unique opportunities to recover with all this new legislation that's passed. Reading has an area where they have a workforce potential to get into manufacturing because of a large swath of different ethnicity in the area.
Yeah, you've got a wide diversity of workers in that area.
And yes, and a lot of the workers that live in the city of Reading travel to the outskirts to work in warehouses that they put in farm fields up near Harrisburg, or they travel to work in farming, which is a lot of times up in Lehigh County, and because there's just not jobs in the greater Reading area that they can fill. But as different manufacturers take advantage of some of these incentives to make things in the U.S., Reading could become an attractive area. And another thing that could make them even more attractive is Reading has always been like the black sheep when it comes to infrastructure. For a lot of manufacturers say, well, I can't manufacture in Reading because the gridlock of getting the product out and into the area is just we don't have the infrastructure. For instance, to get to the Philadelphia area, you know, 422 is two lanes. It still has a lot of traffic lights, or they got to pay to be on the Pennsylvania Turnpike. We don't have a lot of interstate access. Now, over the years, they've improved that access. Like there's great roads now to get up into Lancaster County, but there's still not great roads to get up to Lehigh Valley. There's not great roads to get to the Philadelphia area yet. So as we improve the infrastructure, which can be improved through the bipartisan infrastructure plan that was passed last year, all that plus the diversity of the workforce that could be available in the county, it makes for the ground to support manufacturing, yeah, and get manufacturing investment. And, you know, when you get manufacturing investment in your community, you're not going to be one of the poorest cities in the country anymore. Your city's going to thrive because manufacturing is the cornerstone to the American dream, and it's also the cornerstone to thriving communities.
Where a lot of wealth is created and the jobs that come out of it, especially if they're union jobs. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Dean Showers, former president of Steelworkers Local 6996 in Reading, Pennsylvania, talking a little bit about the past of Reading's glory. Now, one of the things that I did want to bring up with you, because, you know, we became acquainted, you know, more than a decade ago when what was going on at Hoffman Industries, where they evidently they locked people out and eventually ended up breaking the union, as I recall. And you had said something, you know, as we were doing the pre-interview, that that the employer said, look, I don't have a choice here. I've got to pursue the low road because of the policies that are put forth. Now, while I may not be entirely in agreement with that, that seems to be a sentiment that people are throwing out there, that it's the union's fault for pursuing good wages, good benefits, safe working conditions, and that the employers, the only way they can compete is to pay poverty wages with no benefits and dangerous conditions. I'm sorry, I don't agree with that, but I'm curious, you know, in looking back at that moment, what do you remember of it?
Well, yeah, it was, I always call it my bad divorce as far as working. You know, I went out of high school. I went to work for that employer. Really didn't see the end coming like it came in 2017. You know, myself and coworkers were locked out. The lockout lasted 6 years and 2 months. A credit to my incredible coworkers for their commitment to hang in there for a labor dispute, and also the Steelworkers Union for standing behind us for so long when it was just easy enough to walk away after the first year or the second year, yet alone 6 years. But yes, the employer, when we were locked out, you know, it's incredible pressure, basically sent us an email and said, look, unfortunately, the lockout is required because we compete with China, and we can't compete with China with a union contract, union wages, and union benefits. And to answer your previous points, you know, unfortunately, workers are the easiest prey for an employer when things are going south. You know, it's easy to prey on wages and benefits. Those are the easiest things to knock down to stay competitive. I always said, you know, workers deserve as much money as an employer can pay them, because they are the backbone of why you're successful. And to be innovative and competitive, you need well-compensated employees, and you also need a working relationship where both employer and worker can work towards a common goal, and that is for the employer to make money. Unfortunately, and the steelworkers were, they led the charge on this, you know, with the Stand Up for Steel program, which happened maybe 2004, 2005. We started to put an emphasis on all these bad trade agreements that lead up to lockouts like we had at Hoffman and strikes. And that program led into the creation of AAM, who I'm proud to say I work for today, the Alliance for American Manufacturing. We were formed by the steelworkers and some of their largest manufacturers. And we had the sole purpose of coming together on public policy that works for manufacturers. I believe at some point, some of the manufacturers and the steelworkers, when they were negotiating contracts, they said, hey, you know, we can negotiate a contract, a good contract, But eventually, we won't be negotiating at all because the steel industry was under enormous pressure back then. And they were to the point where each year they were going forward operating at a loss. And you've seen that with Bethlehem Steel, one of the giants in steel, huge footprint in the state of PA, shuttering facilities across the state left and right. And the ones that were left running were losing millions of dollars every week they operated. And that was all because they were facing imports from China. And the Chinese were selling steel far less than what they were making it for, with sole purpose of putting the U.S. industry underwater. Yep. And at Hoffman, I would say, you know, we battled for years why it was important for our company to buy steel that was made in the U.S. rather than a boatload of steel that came from China or came from Russia. And the appalling thing was, is even though they knew the quality of the steel that they were getting in for some of their product lines, they were willing to sacrifice some quality for abnormally low prices. And I'll tell you what, when you make a piece of tubing with a coil of steel that came from China and you found out it was like not of great quality, where the grade, the width, everything was variable and you couldn't make a good piece of material out of it, you know, you just throw it away. And they said, that's okay, we'll send you another coil free. And you know, that's repeated over and over in industry, where industry is reaching out for any way they can to save a dollar. And a lot of times that comes on the backs of the employees, but it also comes in the quality of the goods that they're making, which eventually, that's a recipe for disaster, not just with the employees, but with the quality of the product.
Yeah, I argue that's kind of where we are today, Dan. I mean, this is the moment that we're in. And the argument that I hope we're making is there should be a partnership between employees and employers, as there had been in the past, where employees feel a connection to the company and the company to the employees. This has got to be a two-way street. Sadly, over these last couple of decades, that reciprocity hasn't been there, which is why I'm hoping we're in a moment where we start talking about how do unions and companies work together, like the steel workers and the steel industry has done through AAM, to move forward on issues that are important to both of them, and survival, I would argue.
Right. And to correct the record, our lockout started in 2011, lasted till 2017.
Right.
And we sat at the table. The company's offer hadn't changed in the entire 6 years. We tried our best. In 2017, I wouldn't say that the union lost. I mean, we ended up getting a severance agreement for the workers. It wasn't great, but it was something. And
no, I remember. I remember walking the picket line with you. I remember having you guys on all the time talking about this and the heartbreak that came out of that. But again, this is another one of those stories replicated across small towns and across manufacturing hubs all across this country, which is why I think it's important to remember this and talk about the failures of our labor laws to protect workers, the failures of our trade policies to protect industries, and to figure out how do we move this forward. And I think we're in a moment, and maybe you'll agree with me, we're in a moment. I think the Biden administration is moving us in a direction that, you know, quite frankly, is going to hopefully put us back on the path toward that prosperity that we both want.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with you. And I like I said, I work for AAM now. My assignment is I have seven states, four in the Northwest, Alaska, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Colorado, Texas, and Oklahoma. And I can tell you, there's pockets in all those states where manufacturing is starting to improve. There are efforts in Washington to revive the aluminum industry. The machinists lost a big smelter up there recently in Ferndale in Talico. The machinists union and the state AFL-CIO, they're working on a plan to reopen.
It's a whole new game when the Badgers face Oklahoma State for the Guaranteed Rate Bowl in Phoenix on December 27th. Your business can be a part of the action right here on your local Civic Media radio station, locally grown radio 97.5 FM and WFHR 1320 AM. Learn how you can share your Badgers pride during the game, airing locally and streaming everywhere. Call 715-424-1300. 715-424-1300.
The possibility of lung cancer can be pretty scary, especially if you're one of approximately 8 million current or former smokers at high risk. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know that now there's a breakthrough low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early, and it only takes 60 seconds. You stop smoking, now start screening. For an easy quiz to see if you're eligible, visit SaveByTheScan.org. It could save your life. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show, the last segment of the day. If you got something to say, hit us up right now for your crew to tease at 844-967-2789.
I thought they were Crudy Takes.
Crudy's Takes. See, man? It all comes back around to Sports Talk Live.
Something like that.
My wife wants some vegetables for crudité.
You know what I mean?
Listen Monday through Friday from 4 to 6 p.m. for the Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Sweetie, want some fruit?
You have to use the right tool for the job. A power drill is the wrong tool to slice fruit. Just like an antibiotic is the wrong tool to treat viruses, including colds and flu. Antibiotics are only needed for certain bacterial infections. When they aren't needed, antibiotics won't help you, and the side effects could still hurt you. Ask your healthcare professional when an antibiotic is the right tool and when it's not. Visit cdc.gov/antibiotic-use.
My husband, Alex Hussey, was hit by an IED in Afghanistan.
I was point man in foot patrol, and I stopped on the bomb. Lost my legs and left hand in an explosion.
And he suffered a severe traumatic brain injury. Yes.
As America's veterans face challenges, DAV is there.
There are so many mountains to climb, and we do it together.
With the right support, more veterans can reach victories great and small.
Seeing Alex learning how to snow ski, that's life-changing.
DAV provides a lifetime of support to veterans of every generation, helping more than a million veterans each year.
Alex did it. He skied down this mountain. That's something he won't forget.
With the right support, there are no limits.
To see him on that slope and smiling like that, we'll be taking this home.
This has meant so much. Thank you, DAV.
Alex Hussey, thank you for your service. Support more victories for veterans. Go to DAV.org.
What is dedication?
My biggest fear in the middle of my addiction was that my kids wouldn't have a father. I overdosed on heroin, and I lived. And I started thinking, you know what? This isn't my story. My desire to change had finally outweighed my desire to stay the same. I felt powerless for so much of my life. It's important to me that my kids are empowered and truly believe that if they can think it, they can do it. I definitely had to become a better man to be a better father. For the first time, I finally feel like I'm exactly where I should be, where I want to be.
That's dedication. Visit fatherhood.gov to hear more. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Here's your forecast from locally grown radio WFHR. A winter storm warning continues until 6 a.m. Saturday morning. Snow likely tonight, otherwise overcast. Lows dip down to about 3 above. East winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Cloudy tomorrow, snow likely 13 below tomorrow night, chance of snow. 5 to 10 inches of snow tonight through tomorrow. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki. Currently it's 5 above.
Locally grown radio from Vesper to Plover, we are your home for news, talk, and sports. 97.5 FM and WFHR, 1320 AM.
TV, Happy New Year's from Civic Media and Max Inc. Radio. We are local music.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
This is the best of the Rick Smith Show. We're taking a break during the holiday season, wishing you and yours the very best holiday ever.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You know, I remember as a kid, growing up during the Reagan years, they said, we're going to get away from that dirty manufacturing. We're going to do away with that, and we're going to bring in these great service sector jobs. We're going to transform the economy from making stuff to shuffling papers around and doing that kind of stuff. It's going to be great. We're all going to wear white shirts and ties, all going to have corner offices. It's going to be fabulous. We're not going to have to breathe dirty air. We're going to get rid of all that dirty stuff, and it's going to be fabulous. But nobody ever talked about, what are we going to do with all the job losses? What are we going to do with all those working people who are going to lose those jobs? And we were told, service sector, jobs of the future. And as I've said, we can make any job a good job as long as we make them a union job. And here to share some thoughts on, how that transition has gone and maybe where we go in the future and how difficult it's been moving into the future, I've asked Chris Ellis to come talk with us. Chris is a business agent with SEIU 668. Chris, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for inviting me on.
So, here's the thing, and I go back to, when I was a kid, I'm a little bit older than you. I was told, look, we're going to get rid of that dirty manufacturing. Don't need them. We're going to have new jobs. It's going to be great. The jobs of the future are going to be in the service sector, and those are going to be jobs that are going to be able to support families. They didn't. They haven't really kept up. I'm curious your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I know my grandfather worked at Grace Mine, run by Bethlehem Steel down in Southern Berks County, and that was a union job. And obviously that afforded a living for my mother and their family, and a lot of that went away. And I think a lot of that honestly is corporate greed. I mean, we could talk about NAFTA, it certainly opened the door for a lot of stuff, but I think a lot of that stuff was happening regardless and anyway. And we as a society just let it happen. It was like a funnily enough, it's like the giant sucking sound, but yep. I don't think Ross Perot's solutions were the best, but there's a reason that people heard that and they thought, oh yeah, that really resonated with people.
Yeah, I mean, we were sold a bill of goods that we're going to get all these cheap products. Life was going to be great. We're going to get all the stuff we wanted, the conveniences really cheap. And we were going to still be able to keep our standard of living. And for a large number of people in our society, that hasn't been true. Now, look, we've had some gains for some, and I think that's the problem. We've made some people very happy, while the losers have really suffered in this economy, and we haven't done enough to help them, in my view.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Whether it's, I myself was a caseworker working for the state for 15 plus years as a member, well, almost 16 years, member for SEIU 668. And currently the social safety net just isn't sufficient, let alone, the opportunities for people to get jobs, or if they're working two jobs, 20 hours, schedule, they don't know it till the next day. No healthcare, et cetera, just lots of things that unions working together collectively can fight for and win, but our society has made it hard for people to actually organize.
I mean,
but we're definitely seeing a difference now, at least in the service sector, I think, with people getting activated and excited, and hopefully we'll really start to see some gains for people going forward.
And that comes to organizing. That comes with bringing people together and ensuring that we look out for other people's interests. And this is a sign of the moment. I look at, President Biden coming out recently and saying, look, we're going to tackle childhood hunger. We're going to end childhood hunger here in the next couple of years. To me, that's a call to our better angels, but also a policy that's going to help society and move us forward in ways that we haven't talked about in decades.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I mean, some of the things that we realized were possible at the beginning of the pandemic, enhanced unemployment, expanding the earned income tax credit and making it a monthly stipend, expanding SNAP, making it easier for people to apply and retain benefits and stuff. We know that that's possible. It's whether we, you know, actually follow through with that. And then on the other end with jobs, employment, I mean, we're seeing the demand there, you know, as long as something like the Federal Reserve stays out of the way and doesn't try to, in my view, tamp down the worker gains that are slowly but steadily happening right now.
In my view, not just tamping down, but slamming on the brakes as they're doing. Because, look, this is both feet on the brakes, in my view. Because, look, and they've said it. They've come right out, and Powell has said it. The idea is to cause unemployment and lower wages. That's the goal. And sadly, this has been... This has been the bad policy for far too long for working people, which is why I think that anger is there. And I go back to your grandparents and that generation, the fact that you could make a solid living on one income in a productive job that people were attached to. You know, that's a memory I think that people hold on to as something that they want to aspire to. So for me, policy moving forward has got to take that into account, what people want. And then move it into today's technology and today's ability. And that comes to me through unions and good policy.
I 100% agree with you. And I think some of that is also our elected officials not only need to listen to workers, but start to become, you know, more union people have to run for office, to be honest. I know that's somewhat of a side note, but I think you can't, it's hard to implement things if you're talking to people that have never lived those experiences.
No, I absolutely agree with you. But, you know, you look at this, and again, you come from the point where your grandparents were, that they were able to support a family, they had good income jobs, to where, you know, then they, your parents' generation, you know, my generation, my parents' generation, saw deindustrialization happen right before their very eyes. And there weren't policies that were there to help. There wasn't a safety net. It's interesting that as we're losing all those good union jobs and that prosperous working class, you've got a political party, Reagan and those, destroying what social safety net was there to help them in those moments. And I think that's where this anger is. So for me, the path forward is we organize to make lives better. We end hunger. We end homelessness. I'd love to see that happen. But we also help people to become prosperous again and organize in the workplace, because that's where I think we pull this country back together.
I think that's right. I mean, you can just look, our union just specifically was attacked by the former gubernatorial candidate back in 2018, Scott Wagner. He held up funding for unemployment centers. And almost 600 of our workers were laid off. We've since seen permanent unemployment funding. Our union fought back collectively, won lots of gains. And Governor Wolf has certainly done his part to beef up unemployment, but also, you know, stuff like trade jobs, you know, apprenticeships, all the grants that are being put out, like, and there's several apprenticeship places in Berks County that are now reaping the rewards, and workers are coming, and we see a path forward. It's just,
yeah,
you know, expanding that.
Again, smart policy. And I can't hear Scott Wagner's name, the former gubernatorial candidate, without playing the famous.
Well, Governor Wolf, let me tell you, between now and November 6th, you better put a catcher's mask on your face, because I'm going to stomp all over your face with golf spikes, because I'm going to win this for the state of Pennsylvania, and we're throwing you out of office.
Yeah,
because, you know,
yeah,
what? I'm sick and tired of your negative ads.
He's sick and tired of negative ads, but he's going to stand in front of an ad and say he's going to stomp on somebody's face with golf spikes. See, that's the kind of disconnect. And look, I think working people don't want that kind of rhetoric. And in this moment, the policies that are going to move a place like Reading in the right direction, because look, their past was a very proud past of manufacturing, of you know, that Leave It to Beaver kind of environment, that have gone through really, really tough times. Just a couple of years ago, rated the poorest city of its size in the entire country. They're real problems, but the hope is that we're moving somewhere out of it. So can you speak to that a little bit? Are we coming out of that from your perspective?
Well, I do certainly see a path out of it. We do need stuff from the state, like raising the minimum wage, stuff like just more ability for cities to create their own policies, you know, pro-worker policies, pro-family policies, you know, things that are really going to help people. But the poverty level has decreased. There's been a spat of crime, but it has decreased steadily over the past 15 years. You know, people are settling in Reading. The big issue moving forward, I think, is housing costs, you know, because
that's everywhere.
Reading used to be one of the cheapest places to live, and that's not going to be the case coming forward. But
now you're listening.
That's why we need worker power.
I'm right there with you. Listen to the Rick Smith Show with Chris Ellis, business agent with SEIU Local 668. You want to check out their website, SEIU668.org, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Now, I kind of want to end this in a positive direction because, you know, look, the reality is there, your members, public sector workers, have been under just incredible attack. You go back to the last president appointing a Supreme Court justice who was the deciding vote in the Janus decision that created a no rights at work environment for all public sector workers. That was an incredible hit and destructive bit on your union. But I think we're coming to an era right now, Chris, where people are finally waking up to looking at each other for solutions and their unions being part of that, your union being one of the main drivers and moving us towards new policy. I look at what's going on in California with the Fast Recovery Act for fast food workers, the Fight for 15 campaign, this idea that we're reinvigorating and reimagining organizing gives me some hope in this moment. I'm curious your thoughts.
Yeah, I do think that that we're positively going to see some changes, whether it's just with our union. We've really fought throughout the pandemic for worker safety, the ability to telework for some of our office workers, you know, keeping it safe, flexibility, different bonuses for, you know, vaccine leave, you know, stuff like that. But then more generally, like, look at our sister local SEIU Healthcare PA. During this moment, they really went hard against these for-profit nursing homes, and from what I can tell, they won. You know, a lot of this money, the state for safe staffing, stuff like that. There's a lot on the ground, and I think Janus, while tough, has definitely invigorated a lot of the public sector unions, especially SEIU, to really continue to work hard for its members, because a union is only as strong as its weakest link. I mean, it's a pat answer, but I think it really is true. Like, when you go into a shop and, you know, I've been, I think, now 6 shop meetings in the last 2 weeks. People have questions, but they're showing up.
No.
You know,
and no, look, as I've been saying for a long time, this is going to move us in a direction where we have much more militant union members and people like my grandparents' generation, where no matter what you would have done, those are people who would have fought through to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, because they were committed to each other. And I think we're moving away from the me generation back to a we generation, and that is a good thing for working people. So I applaud the leadership that you guys are providing and leading us in a good direction, but also the people who are coming together and fighting for that. So I have great hope, and I have hope that Reading is going to come firing back, and those jobs of the future, those good jobs are going to support people's livelihoods, are going to be union jobs, and maybe, you know, we're going to look to the past thoughtfully and pridefully, but also be happy in the moment as well. But Chris, I appreciate you taking some time, sharing your thoughts on the area. Really great talking with you.
Thanks for inviting me.
Good stuff. Chris Ellis, he is a business agent with SEIU Local 668. Love to hear your thoughts as we're spending our time here in Reading, sharing some thoughts of what was, what is, and what can be. That's that, to me, the focus, what can be and what we can do to make things better. Love to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. Today's program was recorded during our Working Class Heroes radio tour this past October. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1945. That was a day known in Hollywood as Black Friday. After World War II, the movie industry began to rake in profits. But they did not pass those profits along to their employees. 10,000 members of the Conference of Studio Unions were on strike. They were part of the Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners. They were also in a jurisdictional battle with the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, or IATSE, over who should represent stage decorators. The strike wore on for half a year. The studios had more than 100 films backlogged and were able to wait out the strikers. But as the strike continued, and the studios remained silent, pressure mounted. Despite the tensions between the two unions, thousands of IATSE members refused to cross the picket lines. On Black Friday, the strikers decided to concentrate their efforts at the Warner Brothers Studios gate. 300 picketers gathered to hold the line. Scabs, hired by Warner Brothers, tried to drive through the workers' picket lines to the studio. Variety accounted what happened next, writing, quote, "Strikers deployed from their barricades, halted non-strikers, and rolled three automobiles on their sides. By noon, reinforcements arrived from both sides. Firemen were called in to turn their hoses on the striking workers. Warner Brothers security deployed tear gas. Common for the time, accusations were hurled that the Conference of Studio Union Strikers were communists. As a result of the strike, the Conference of Studio Union's employees were assigned to other jobs in the studios. When they refused, they were locked out. The union never recovered. The violence at the Warner Brothers Studios gate also helped to fuel the passage of the Taft-Hartley Act through Congress, which eroded union protections. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show. We'll be returning live and in studio on January 3rd. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Tons of thoughts on where we should be going. And sadly, we can't hit every state. Tour for the future, perhaps. I've got a lot of people saying, you got to come to Florida, you got to come to Texas. And I'm going, yeah, a lot of working class heroes in Florida and Texas and, you know, all throughout the southern U.S., which would love to maybe next year. But this tour focusing on getting through Pennsylvania, we're going to do that here in the next couple of days, hitting up Scranton tomorrow on the program, Erie the day after. And then we're heading over to Detroit, going to have an event there with our friends at One Fair Wage to make sure we make sure that work pays. Yeah. I know, rough concept. I'm going to spend some time in Michigan, then off to Chicago for our movie event with Greg Palast and the Reverend Jesse Jackson at Rainbow Push. Make sure that you're available. Make sure you register. Got to do that. WCPT820.com for our listeners in Chicago. If you want to come to our October 11th program to see the movie Vigilante with Greg Palast and also the Reverend Jesse Jackson. On the 12th, we're going to be in Minneapolis. Our friends at AM 950, we're going to be doing a screening of Greg Palast's movie there. Also have to pre-register. It's free, all free, but you got to register because we want to make sure, you know, we'll make sure we have seats for everybody. So make sure you register for that as well. If you got questions, let me know. Email me personally, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. We'll make sure that you get tickets and get in the door and get to meet Greg, get to see the movie, and maybe me. You get to say hello to me if you need to. But all of that, looking forward to those events. And then into Iowa, into Wisconsin, back through Ohio, and then home. Going to be an adventure. And look, you know, as I said at the beginning, little hiccup, this stuff happens to families all the time. It's just right now it's happening to my family. My son is doing very well. Surgery went well. Doctor's happy. He is hysterical. I wish I had half the funny that he's got, but doing really well, and we're really happy about that. But again, I come back to this could happen to any family, and I'm again where I started, grateful that I don't have that concern that this is gonna destroy me. And this is why I think we need to be moving towards something of a national health insurance program. I know the Affordable Care Act is trying. I know there's some good things in there. But the problem is, and again, it comes back to the problems that we have with the ACA that aren't going to get fixed until we demand they get fixed. Look, I'm not against the ACA. I think it's a good start. It's a good start. It's good to get us where we need to go. It's a good first step. Absolutely. But premiums are high in some cases in states where they're not helping, but deductibles are high, copays, that stuff is, stuff's there. I've heard stories from people, and if you've got stories, I want to hear them. The one person told me they had a $4,000 deductible, and if in November something happens, it's $4,000. And then if something in January happens, it's another $4,000. You're now right back to where you started from, worrying about, can you pay for medical debt? And in this country, the wealthiest country in the nation, or in the nation, the wealthiest country on the planet, the wealthiest nation in the history of civilization, at its wealthiest moment. Isn't that what we should want for our neighbors, for our friends, for our families, for ourselves? For our children, is this not it? And I know this is where you go, but Rick, we're going to give it to other people. Other people are going to get it, and MS-13 is going to come. And you go, humanity. We take care of people, right? Isn't again Christian nation kind of thinking? Don't we help? Aren't we supposed to help? And why would we and this is where this is just twisted to me. Why would we then say, I'm not going to have security for myself and my children because I don't want someone else to have it? I want everyone to have the good fortune that our family has had through this moment. The opportunity to care solely about what happens to our child and to get them what they need when they need it, without spending all the time worrying about, hey, is this going to destroy us? And that, for that, I'm grateful. And as we leave Reading and head towards Scranton, and I'm looking forward to Scranton because we're going to, I've got a coal tour set up. We're looking to see the coal industry and some coal mining, going to get the hard hat on and be grateful that I don't work in the coal industry, to be honest. I've done this tour once, it's been years. Looking forward to that and the discussions we're going to have around it. But as we're leaving, I can't get my head around the fact that this is still one of the poorer communities in the country, and how in this moment we have an opportunity to help communities like Reading, like Allentown, like Scranton, where we're going, to revive that manufacturing prowess, that ability to create those solid working class jobs. Now, look, all these areas are trying to go high tech. They're trying to go healthcare. They're trying to go education. And a lot of them are. They're doing well. And that's great. But I'm worried about the working folks. I'm worried about the working stiff, people like me, people like you, who punch a clock, who just want to support their families, who want their labor to matter and it to be compensated at a level where they can take care of their families. That doesn't seem to be, I don't know, too much to ask for. And manufacturing, I think what the Biden administration is doing to try and reshore some manufacturing, trying to invest in new technologies so that manufacturing is done here and that companies don't, in their self-interest, in their radical self-interest, go to where they can get the cheapest, most exploitable labor. There's some policies to keep manufacturing here. Also, infrastructure. There are some infrastructure projects on the road right now, and we haven't been on the road a lot yet. But there are a lot of those orange cones all over the place. A lot of people with hats on doing a lot of road work. That's happened. Why? We need the sign, man.
I'm a wife and the mother of two kids, and I've got a good job.
Bye, Mom.
See you, Mom.
A pretty important job. Because of my family and my job, I really care about this neighborhood. It's a good neighborhood. Yes, there's some crime. And when I drive to work, like now, I realize that some people here don't trust the police. So the police should be reaching out to this community, and this community should reach out to the police. That's the way to make this a safer place. And when I get to work in the precinct house and put on my uniform, I can tell you, as a police officer, that this department is reaching out to the community, and the community is doing its part. We're building partnerships. This should be happening everywhere. This is how we can all be safer. Get involved. Start the conversation.
Start the conversation and help stop crime. To learn the five things you can do, go to ncpc.org/preventviolentcrime. A message from the National Crime Prevention Council and the Bureau of Justice Assistance.
WFHR, Wisconsin Rapids, 1320 AM and W248D.